Merħba, l-semmija ta' Campus 103.7, Emanuel Buttigieġ u Liam Gawċi jilqgħukom għal taħdita Clio. Liam, kif taf sewwa f'dawn il-ġimgħat li għaddew, kien hemm titlu li kienet iddomina fil-gazzetti lokali u li ma kellux jaqsam ma' skandli politiċi jew internazzjonali, kienet is-sejba interessantissima dwar il-preżenza tal-bniedem fuq dawn il-gżejjer. U bi-pjaċir magħna għandna tnejn il-protagonisti ta' din is-sejba, għandna l-professur Eleanor Sherry li hija parti mill-Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology u l-Università ta' Malta, u l-professur Nicolas Vella li huwa parti mid-Dipartiment tal-Klassiċi u l-Arkeoloġija fih dan il-Fakultà tal-Arti tal-Università ta' Malta. Eleanor, Nicolas, thank you so much for being with us and for being able to share your insights with the listeners of our station. You are the authors, together with others, of this new study, which is published in Nature, which in itself is obviously a very prestigious publication. The title of the article reads, Hunter-Gatherer Sea Voyages Extended to Remotest Mediterranean Islands. Now, at first glance, that doesn't sound terribly exciting, but that's sort of the nature of academic journals. You know, they give you these bland titles, in a sense. But really, behind this, what seems deceptively simple, is an extraordinary story that you've been able to start piecing together. And that's, of course, what we're going to be discussing today and in a following episode. So we thought that to start us off, because we've read a lot about how, you know, you've pushed back the presence of humans on these islands. But what was the story before your discovery broke? So what was the state of knowledge, and how does your discovery revise that state of knowledge?
Yeah, so obviously for the Maltese Islands, we knew that the first people to arrive here, or so we thought, were farmers around 7,500, 7,400 years ago. And we thought they were the first people to arrive on Malta. And more broadly, if we go back in time to the time of the last European hunter-gatherers, so it's a time period known as the Mesolithic, we thought that these people were experimenting with the maritime lifestyle, but they were not able to reach small and remote islands. And this is for two reasons. This is because hunter-gatherers obviously are not farmers. They can't intensively grow food as crops in fields. They have to gather and hunt what they can find and what nature provides. So small islands cannot sustain large populations of hunter-gatherers. And so it was thought it was either beyond their technological ability to get to small islands, or it wasn't worth the attempt.
What would be the point, right?
So what would be the point? Mm. And of course, it was long thought that the maritime technology required to get to small and remote islands was something that somehow came with the farming changes. So obviously farming represented a profound change in the lifestyles of people. They started to produce food and domesticate animals, and required not just a profound change in lifestyle, but also came with a lot of innovations. And maritime technology was for some time assumed to be part of those general innovations. And so we see this sort of idea of a sharp division between the last European hunter-gatherers and the first farmers. So this is a pretty different state of affairs to what we actually discovered on Malta.
Right. So it does show that they have an ability to travel long distances and occupy small territory.
Yeah. So, you know, I think while we've made a big sort of rightfully so deal about the fact that we've pushed back the occupation of Malta by 1,000 years, to me, the key story is it's pushed into a completely different time period. And this is the time period of Europe's lost hunter-gatherers into the Mesolithic period. And, you know, they're people that subsisted in a completely different way to the first farmers, had a completely different lifestyle, cosmology, everything you can imagine. But also, because we know they got to Malta and they would have had to make these very long sea journeys in a time before sails to get there, we can also ask questions, you know, where else did these people go? And have we stumbled across a pan-Mediterranean network of Mesolithic seafarers that we never knew existed before? So it's opened up a whole new area of research.
I have around 900 questions after that. So these discoveries are based on an archaeological, let's say, find at Latnia.
Yes.
Right? So trying to put context for our listeners. So this area, this excavation started to yield this information. But I'm going to ask a personal question. Mm. When did you realize that you're onto something special?
Well, I mean, I think from the very first field season.
I'm jumping the gun, sorry.
Yeah. So back in 2019, we started the project at Latnia, and it wasn't ostensibly to look for hunter-gatherers. I mean, obviously, that's not really how science progresses. You're sort of testing various hypotheses. And what I was interested in was from two ends. I wanted to understand the natural history of Malta a little bit better, because part of my research themes is trying to understand the human impact on natural ecosystems and what the transition from pristine natural systems to human-dominated landscapes looks like.
Okay.
And because my research typically deals with human evolution in very remote time periods in Africa, in my research in Africa, I started to come across evidence of people altering ecosystems from a very early stage in the human story. And part of that story is also so-called megafaunal collapse. So when humans leave Africa about 50,000 years ago, everywhere they go, large land animals seem to collapse and die. So like mammoths and giant sloths, all these animals start to die. So there's a huge global debate about not just whether humans are responsible for this, are they, you know, overkilling these animals, are they hunting them to extinction, but what the ecosystem effects of the loss of these animals is, because, you know, they do things like cycle nutrients, control wildfires, all sorts of ecosystem effects that make ecosystems more resilient against climate change. But studying these things is very difficult if you're looking at huge land masses like Asia or Africa or North America.
Of course.
Looking at islands is a really interesting way to have a sort of a microcosm of trying to understand this. So I thought, okay, well, in Malta, we had our own miniaturized megafauna, these like pygmy elephants and hippos. We don't really know when they died out, what they did for these ecosystems. And, well, was there anything left of them when humans first appeared? And, you know, when did humans first appear? Because what I'd always read is that the earliest Ardalam finds looked like a society that maybe wasn't the first wave of arrivals. So maybe it was a first generation or a second generation. So, you know, could we capture those moments of first arrival on Malta? And then could we sort of piece together that story of ecosystem change? So that's what we were after back in 2019 and why we started digging at Latnia.
And I suppose a linking question is, what took you there in the first place? Why Latnia in Melliha and not anywhere else?
I think there's several reasons for that. So first of all, it's, you know, I've been working in hunter-gatherer archaeology for 20 years, so you do get a sense of place.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people think of hunter-gatherers as cavemen, you know, and they think they're going to live in these deep, dark, nasty caves full of insects and damp conditions where actually, like, no one wants to be, you know, like, no one wants to live in a place like that. Usually you find them in places where you'd want to camp. So a rock shelter, a little bit of an overhang. And Latnia is special because it is part cave, but it's also part rock shelter. It's incredibly sheltered from the local environment. There's water, and it's also a sediment trap, which means that we could expect depth to the archaeology. Because a lot of archaeological sites in Malta are very shallow.
Of course.
But, you know, if you're looking at a sediment trap, then, of course, it'd be much deeper. And a lot of caves are sediment traps, but a lot of them have been emptied in antiquity to create space for, like, goats, sheep, and there's no sediment left. And Latnia is too big to remove the sediment from. And it's funny because my colleague here, Nick, like, had independently thought about investigating the site, and we sort of came together.
Okay.
And I actually went there with a professor of geography, Ritian Gauchi, because I didn't know about the site. And the minute I saw it, I was like, you know, this is the place. So actually, I think all three of us came together on the site. And 2019, we started digging. We dug a one-by-one test trench. We found all the usual stuff, you know, down to sort of temple period, but that, you know, Neolithic. But then the archaeology kept going, but there was no pottery and the animals were no longer domesticated species. But we had stone tools, deer, you know, so we knew straight away that there was something really off about the sequence. It didn't look like any sequence we'd found in Malta before. I don't know if you want to chime in there.
This was in a 1x1 meter. That's how we started, because our request to the Superintendent of Cultural Heritage was to have trial trenches and to test what the deposits were like. The site had been on our radar even. Well, my first visit there was when I started teaching a course for my sins on North African prehistory. I was aware of a very important site in Cyrenaica in Libya, where they had, you know, 80,000 years of history in this amazing one site. And I had recalled that I had hiked to Latnia when I was a kid, a teenager, I think. And then I went there again and I said, this is amazing, even because there had been a bit of news when I was a student that the site had a surface scatter of Neolithic pottery. So it was on our radar. And also a colleague of ours, Keith Bahajar, had been saying that it could have been used in medieval times as a troglodytic settlement. And then
was a lot of melee, huh?
Fast forward the whole thing. And when we were trying to see what we could do, then the site was an obvious choice. And of course, when we sunk this one by one, this is where the surprises started, because as Eleanor was saying, you don't find the pottery, but you find remains of gastropods, and they don't reach the site on their own. And then you start finding seashells. And
I want to stop you there so that our listeners can understand. So what's so special if you don't find pottery?
Well, usually pottery is associated with farmers. That's the earliest pottery we've known in Malta archaeologically. A particular type of pottery, which we call Ardalam in Prestwyr, and you find none of that. And yet you're finding other remains which can't have found their way to the cave on their own, in a context which is not mixed with any modern disturbance whatsoever, and then you have to try and explain it. And that is when we started realizing we could be onto something. And of course, analyses were carried out, in particular dating. Mm-hmm. And of course, because if we wanted to take the investigation further and extend the one-by-one trench, you have to justify that with the state regulator, who will tell you, you know, why do you want to excavate any further? On the basis of what? And of course, that is where then in the course of COVID, we were waiting for these results to start coming in, and the whole thing took off from there.
Related to this, because I read that you excavated about 40 centimeters. Is that right in terms of depth?
No, the depth is it's deeper than that.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I think it probably goes down to a meter, I would say.
Just over a meter.
Okay.
Yeah.
And at what point did you start finding the evidence that made you go, aha, something is different?
When I was stuck in this one by one, obviously, like, only one person fits in there, so I was just like contorting myself in all kinds of strange positions to like stay comfortable while we were digging. And you know, I think for me, so the pottery stopped, but the stone tools continues. And I'd never been in a situation in Malta with stone tools without the pottery. So it's like, you know, there is there are the artifacts of everyday life. You would not expect to find stone tools without pottery.
And the stone tools, their design, their make, is it something that you had seen in your studies from anywhere else, or was it typically Maltese or made out of Maltese stone?
They were first of all, they were mostly made on limestone, which was like a strange thing. So the Neolithic people tend to choose a local chert,
yes,
not limestone, and also from what I knew of the stone tools or the sort of Neolithic period, they have a lot of things like scrapers and a lot of retouch tools, where, you know, you what I mean by that is, you know, you get a block of raw material and you strike off a flake of stone, and then you subsequently reshape that using the, you know, an antler or another rock. You're sort of shaping like flakes of stone. And there was none of that. They're like these very expediently produced flakes with no subsequent modification, made on limestone. And that's interesting in itself, because it's clear that the limestone degrades when it's exposed to the elements. So these were quite rapid burials, still sharp edges, so like really good condition. But it does make you wonder how much may have been missed if you have a hunter-gatherer population living on Malta making flakes out of limestone that are then exposed to the elements. You will not recognize them as stone tools anymore. They just look like rocks.
Right.
So that was also interesting for us.
So is that suggesting that they're using them and discarding them quite quickly?
Yeah, so it's typical, you know, if you have an abundant raw material and you're using something like limestone, which is everywhere on Malta, then you're not going to curate the stone tools because you can just like...
chuck it away.
Yeah, just chuck it and get some more later. It's a very, very easy thing to do. And
all around you, so
it's all around. But this was also combined with cooked animal waste. So, you know, the bones were burned. And we know subsequently we found things like butchery marks on the bones, you know, using microscopes.
So they're going for the bone marrow and...
They were going for the bone marrow. They were smashing up the bones, extracting the marrow. They were cooking tortoises, but they were you know, the burning was only on one side. So they're sort of using the shell to
cook on it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. So a lot of these interesting features that really speak to humans. But I mean, of course, there were ash tips at the site that were... 40 centimeter thick ash tips next to like the remains of hearths. And what's really interesting about hearths archaeologically is if you have one episode of burning, it generally doesn't leave a trace. It just all blows away.
Yeah, we've done that on a camping.
No? Yeah. So experimental archaeology shows that to leave a trace archaeologically, you generally need the same place to have repeated burning episodes up to 25 times to leave like a trace. And these hearths that we found were
sustained over
thick.
Time.
They were incredibly thick hearths, which is probably hundreds and hundreds of burning episodes. And what they seem to be doing is clearing out the ash, dumping it next to the fireplace, and then reusing the fireplace.
Because obviously ash will keep away insects.
Well, they're obviously clearing it out like you clear out your fireplace if you have an ash buildup and, you know, it stops the fire from burning.
No, you have to clean.
But they're chucking lots of other things in the fire. They're chucking their food waste in the fire. You know, they're eating their venison steaks and then chucking the bones back in. And it's basically domestic waste of these people's everyday lives. But we discovered this incredibly varied diet. I mean, thousands and thousands of bones of many different animals, and it really contrasts to, say, the farming diet, which perhaps you'd like to talk about.
Which tends to be a bit more boring.
More boring. Sheep, goat, pig, cattle.
Wheat and no seafood.
And essentially, that's it. And hardly any seafood.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about old excavations where you would not be sieving the deposit properly to make sure that nothing is lost. Mm. But even from recent excavations, we still miss the marine element in the diet.
So there's clearly a different diet here, and so absolutely. That's why you're going for the hunter gatherer. Yes, please. So when you're talking about Latnia, we're talking about this. What's the evidence? So it's are they there on a? It's a base. Are they moving along? Are they hunting around Malta and coming back to Latnia, or are they here for the summer?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to know all the answers yet.
Of course,
but we are, you know, these are very interesting questions. So it is a home base, like we would call that a home base for like hunter gatherers. But hunter gatherers have a sort of very different mobility pattern to typically to farmers. So farmers, you know, they're sedentary. They'll live in one place and they'll invest their labor into like the fields around where they live and defend that. Whereas hunter-gatherers will have a home base, but then they radiate outwards into the world. And the extent to which they radiate outwards depends on the carrying capacity of the land that they live in. So a semi-arid place like Malta has quite a low carrying capacity. This is defined by net primary productivity of plants. Mm. And therefore, they would have had to use the whole island to be able to get enough food around the year. And it would have been a pretty small population, which probably suggests that there would have to have been a degree of coming and going. It's not possible for the island to sustain a population of hunter-gatherers over a long period.
So that gives us a connection.
It
These
does.
Guys were maritime people.
It would indicate coming and going, repeated and sustained seafaring, in my view.
Okay. So there's the sense that probably from Sicily, no, we're thinking that there's regular trips or fairly regular trips happening there.
Yes.
So instead, what you're describing is a form of like an extended long weekend that these people are having. They come from Sicily for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, it's hard to tell whether they were here for a few years or whether they came seasonally. Is not something we know.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But we do have a lot of these edible marine gastropods. So apart from limpets, we have something called like Phocus turbinatus, which is this edible marine top shell. If you saw it, you'd recognize it. They have these little black dots over them. And you find them in rock pools all around Malta.
And what is Imhar?
I'm not sure.
No, they're not Amhar. Amhar would be limpid.
No, but using isotopic evidence, we can reconstruct the season of collection. So when these things died. And so we have 250 currently under study. Each one has individually radiocarbon dated and has an isotopic signature. So we're waiting for the results, and this will give us a huge picture in seasonality.
So we'll see you next week.
Are they picking them all year round? Are they picking these things all year round, or is it?
Oh, is it
seasonal collection?
I would like to we're nearing. We've got around 7 minutes to go for this episode. Obviously, we're going to keep you for another one because there's so many. But I would like to end this with some description of the food that we're seeing. So the maritime evidence that so are there fish bones? Yes.
So there's fish like grouper, which is a very interesting fish to find there.
Yes, because grouper. So if it's a large grouper,
it's a large fish. Yes.
It's a large fish.
We also have marine reptiles.
We're
just discovering probably Mario Mata Gonzalez, who is our zooarchaeology postdoc today, thinks he might have found sea turtles.
Okay, that's something which has been eaten on the island forever.
Yes,
and it's very easy to catch.
Literally, and one thing we've also been doing is collecting all the bone fragments that in the past would have been discarded because you can't identify them. But we've been doing something called Zooms, which is zooarchaeology by mass spectrometry, where we've been protein fingerprinting the bones, and we've found whale bones.
Really?
May have dolphins, still trying to work that out. Obviously, a sort of fish, but lots of, you know, sea urchins, crabs. It's not like 80% of the diet, but it's a substantial part. Mostly, there's a lot of birds in there as well, so they're catching birds.
Catching birds.
But, your colleague Hugh Groschut was saying that you found something like 10,000. Sea snail shells.
Yes, this is the stuff we're doing the seasonality work on.
Well, that's impressive. But from that, I mean, can you infer the number of people that would have been around or for how long?
It's difficult.
What's possible with...
Yeah, I mean, no, that will give us seasonality data. The shells won't tell us how many people were there because it's very difficult. You know, you can get an accumulation like that very quickly over a year from a few people, you know, contributing. But, you know, I think for us, the population reconstruction will come if we have any ancient DNA. We're still waiting to see if we have that. So that will give us, for example, insights into population size, inbreeding. We don't expect the population size to be big. We already know that it wasn't big in Sicily, and they were quite inbred there too. And obviously, it's a much bigger island. So
imagine what's happening here.
what's definitely the case with like hunter-gatherers. These people couldn't have survived here isolated for very long periods of time.
Yes, and the animals you're talking about, a whale. To catch a whale, this needs to be a group of people.
And get to it after it's beached as well.
Yeah, it's ruling out whether it's a beached animal.
Of course, yes. Yeah. Very valid point.
Yeah.
And the larger animals, so when we talk about land animals, so we've got venison.
We've got deer, we've got tortoises.
Land tortoises?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, lots of land tortoises. We found fox there, which is interesting because, you know, it's possible that people were using the pelts of foxes.
Of course.
That was very interesting as well because, you know, animals like foxes and deer are supposed to have gone extinct a really long time ago. So some of the information from, for example, sites like Ardalam suggested that they went extinct back in the Pleistocene. But we know that they're alive and well in the early...
So you keep pushing... This is the beauty about this. We keep pushing our known world into so many new different ways.
And maybe to wrap up this first episode, maybe we should have started with this as well. But what would have Malta looked like? I mean, I don't think it was bigger as such in terms of its surface area. But is it more a forest? Is there more forest?
I wanted to ask that.
Is it greener?
It was slightly bigger than it is today, but not much. So the distance to Sicily wouldn't have been like really affected.
Right.
There was a bit more of a sort of a shore platform on the north of Malta and Malta, Comino and Gozo had a skinny connection between them, so it was just about still an island, 8,500 years ago, but just about a really skinny little connection.
You know, the Gozotans would love that.
It was, they would hate it.
No, it would be easy for a bridge. Instead of a bridge, it's just a road now.
There were no Gozotans, only Maltese.
Yeah, so sea levels were 20 to 25 meters lower than today, about 8,500 years ago. So, you know, not
trees?
A huge difference.
Is that,
I mean, the area around Latnia from the archaeobotanical work we've been doing doesn't look substantially different, but it wouldn't have been so degraded. So they would have had more shrubby plants. You would have had the
a stronger maki, the gargar tree as well.
Gargar tree, junipers, lots of lentisk bushes like we see today. But yes, other parts of Malta, like the valleys, may have been more wooded. But certainly, like, our area was probably always fairly exposed and shrubby.
Mm-hmm. We are nearing the end of this first episode, and I think I would like to obviously keep some of our ammunition for the next episode. But as a recap of what we said is that this the Latnia cave gave us this opportunity to have an undisturbed site where we can start asking these questions. It is now, it stands right now, without the new information coming in with the test that you're doing. In as its position, the importance of it for us. Let's start with Malta, and then we're going to go to Sicily in the next episode. How important is it?
I mean, it's the only site we know of in Malta that carries traces of every single period of human prehistory and later history in Malta. So to me, it's you can't go there and you won't see a temple. You won't see something as impressive as like the Hypogeum, but it is, you know.
But the site itself is impressive. You don't need to build anything.
Yes, it's like a cathedral.
Because the site is impressive, and I don't know. We don't know of any other site like it. This short of Maqlouba, I suppose, but it hasn't got a proper shelter like this one has. So it is quite unique. And, of course, it's a very important archaeological resource at the moment.
Yeah, and not just for Malta, but for Europe and the world, because, you know, if you want to contrast it with something amazing like the temples are fantastic. They're Europe's first monumental buildings. They're very important everywhere, you know, not just for us. But they're a phenomenon that gives insights onto prehistoric Maltese people. But what we found at Latnia gives insights into the prehistoric Mediterranean region and a period in prehistory, Europe's last hunter-gatherers, and that it's illuminating that history for the entire region.
Europe's last hunter-gatherers. I'm looking forward to next week, where we're going to be talking a little bit more about this amazing study. Professor Sherry, Professor Vella, thank you for coming on behalf of Emmanuel Buttigieg. Thank you, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.